another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z, and I'm real glad to be here. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zampro, naturopathic physician, herbalist, professor at the University of Bridgeport, and your host for this edition. Dr. Kamai has the day off, and we'll be talking to Dr. Victoria Mazes, I think that's how you say her name, and she is a wonderful author and wrote this great book called Be Fruitful, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. So for those people that are kind of in that stage of life, this is a very well-rounded approach to ensuring a successful pregnancy. Also, guys, too, will gain a valuable insight in regard to their own physical and mental health. And we know that today women have a harder time getting pregnant than ever before. And that might be because they're waiting longer to have kids, or there's more environmental toxins, processed foods, malabsorption, celiac disease, weight gain, and other stressors kind of always being in the digital world. And that might be interesting, although I'm going to pose to Dr. Victoria the question that, you know, my wife was a public health nurse for years, and she saw the most ardent crackhead women in the worst health conceiving left and right. So I want to play devil's advocate here and tell her about those types of things. But anyway, let's bring her on the show. Welcome, Dr. Victoria.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be on.
Great. Great to have you. So I know you've got involved in integrated medicine, which is very wonderful. Tell us a little bit about where you work, and I know you work out in the Arizona Center for Integrated Medicine.
Yes, that's right. I'm the executive director for the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, and I've been here for 15 years, the first two as a fellow, and then afterwards as a director.
Great. Well, that's very exciting. It's a wonderful program, and, you know, it's nice to have allopathic doctors. You know, I decided from the get-go that I was going to be holistic, and I thought that naturopathic medicine was a better match than becoming an allopathic doctor and then kind of doing it after the fact. But the fact of the matter is that there's a lot more medical doctors out there, certainly, and this is a good way to go. Tell us a little bit about the program there.
Yes, so at the Arizona Center for Integrative Medicine, it's an academic program, so we do research, we have a clinic, but primarily we focus on education. Mm-hmm. And we have this large fellowship training program. It's a two-year fellowship. We've had almost 1,000 physicians, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants go through that program, and they're all over the country and to some extent all over the world. So I agree with just what you said. It's a way for physicians to learn what they ought to have learned in medical school, but often didn't, to learn about nutrition, mind-body influences, botanicals, the influence of physical activity beyond you should get some exercise, energy, acupuncture, Ayurveda. So really the full curriculum and the much wider range of tools that you'd ideally want to bring to patient care.
Yeah, and they're applying them not like what people say, you know, green allopathy, like, for instance, just substitute St. John's Wort for Prozac. You know, there's a much deeper, in-depth assessment that we're just not the absence of drugs, that our diseases are just not the absence of drugs. A headache's just not the an aspirin deficiency, or in your case, fertility.
I agree. That's absolutely true. Yeah. So there is this philosophy that the relationship between patient and provider, respecting that human beings are dynamic healing systems, and when someone has something, whether it's a headache or heart disease, that there may be a root cause to the illness. Can you get to the root cause? Can you help reverse what's going on? Can you have an approach that really allows someone to fully restore their health as opposed to just perhaps masking symptoms with a pharmaceutical? But we're integrative, so that doesn't mean we never use pharmaceuticals. There's definitely a time and a place when you're happy to have those in your tool bag.
Yeah, I mean, we don't live in the Stone Age anymore. So, yeah, we have to have balance. And I know one of the things that caught me about your wonderful book was, in I practice Chinese medicine, and certainly I love this saying, and it was said by one of your teachers, that in Western medicine, the primary focus is almost entirely upon dispelling evil. So, you know, we need to preface that with the listeners that evil in Chinese medicine is not just being sinister and nefarious in your thinking and deeds, but it's actually the influence of the elements and other things. Of course, Chinese medicine predating the germ theory, but you continue, you say, think about many of our medications. We have antibiotics to remove bacteria, antihistamines, stop the release of histamine, antihypertensives. But in Chinese medicine, and I guess more integrative approaches, on the other hand, reminds us that we need to support the good, not only stop the evil. And that's where we, rather than attacking the bacteria or dispelling the blood pressure, the goal is to bring the person's body back to harmony so that it can deal and heal itself with its own physical challenges. And that kind of sets the stage for your book and transitioning into fertility, because there are obstacles to cure that you have to deal with if a woman has too much scarring in the fallopian tubes or there's some endocrine issues. But your approach is really to use a balanced approach to help women in this, and men too, I guess.
Yes, so you were quoting one of my teachers, Dr. Qingkai Zhang, who said that the entire purpose of medicine from a traditional Chinese medicine perspective can be summed up in five words: dispel evil and support the good. Mm. And what I write about is that in Western medicine, our focus has been primarily on dispelling evil, and we haven't attended well enough to supporting the good. And it's not that that concept doesn't exist at all in Western medicine. We learn about homeostasis, but it's certainly not an emphasis of Western medicine. And so in this area of fertility, where women are struggling, for sure there are the high-tech options, and some of those high-tech options in assisted reproductive technologies are truly miraculous. I just argue that, we shouldn't necessarily start there, that there are so many things that women and men can do to bring their body back into harmony, to enhance their natural healing systems, and that will likely help them conceive more easily. And then the startup to your show today, you talked a little bit about the fact that we have rampant obesity. Obesity actually interferes with conception. So does being underweight. People are exposed to hundreds or thousands of environmental chemicals every day. Many of these are endocrine disruptors, so they're going to interfere with normal hormonal function. Well, that's very scary, but there are things we can do to greatly reduce our environmental chemical exposures and enhance our endocrine system. There are the standard American diet, the acronym SAD, the standard American diet is the worst diet for fertility. It's high in processed food, which means that you're getting exactly the wrong kind of carbohydrates, which bump up insulin levels, which affects the whole hormonal cascade. It is high in the wrong kinds of fats, the wrong kinds of proteins. And so from a nutritional perspective, there's much that can be done, and so on. So really, there's much that can be done in terms of lifestyle. And then honoring some of the traditional systems in Be Fruitful, I do write about traditional Chinese medicine and also about Ayurveda and some of the approaches from those systems of medicine that can be brought to bear. Now, there is a chapter in Be Fruitful on conventional medicine, because as I said, there are miraculous advances that allow people to have children who in prior times would never have been able to have a child. It's just not where I tend to start. Right.
Like I was looking at, well, just to buttress one of your points, that fat or adiposity actually holds a lot of those toxins. Plus, it becomes kind of an evil in itself in releasing a lot of the adipokines, those wicked chemicals that interfere with and create inflammation in the body and make it. But let me, before we actually get into that, what about my first point? Like my wife was a public health nurse in Long Island for many years, and she saw that many of the women who were unfortunately addicts, and they were conceiving left and right. And of course the babies weren't too healthy, that's for sure, and I guess that's the big goal, is to have a healthy pregnancy. But it did not seem, it seemed like the more abuse they put on their body, it did not affect their conception rate, let's put it that way.
So I think that's part of the larger mystery. And we do all we can to set the stage for conception. And in Be Fruitful, I do speak to the things we have control over, what we eat, whether there are particular vitamins and dietary supplements, the stress management practices, the way to reduce environmental toxins, the appropriate physical activity. At the same time, we recognize that creating life is actually beyond our control.
Right.
Even with assisted reproductive technologies where everything is superseded and in some sense life is created in a test tube, well, it's not life, it's an embryo. And the medical scientists still can't create life. We can create a multiple-celled pre-human, I guess you could say, that can be implanted in a uterus and perhaps become a living being, but there is an element of mystery. There, whether you believe in a higher power or you believe in God, there is a part of the creation of life that is outside of our control. And I think that's the only way to answer why someone who does everything right, who follows every precept for healthy living, doesn't conceive. And another person who, as you described, may be taking the worst possible care of their body and yet unintentionally becomes pregnant.
And we see it, I mean, you know, we see it all the time just in fields outside of fertility. But, you know, I always say it's a crapshoot. You don't know if you know, you're going to be like your grandpa who smoked, swore, gambled, and did all kinds of other things like that. You know, you don't really know. I mean, genetics is just part of it. So that's how
genetics
I answer that
Genetics are part
question
of it, for
too.
Sure. Although, you know, I do think that there's very compelling evidence that lifestyle turns out to have an overwhelming effect on how long we live. I mean, there's multiple articles now that have shown that if you don't smoke, are not obese, get reasonable exercise, which is usually defined as about a half hour a day, eat a Mediterranean-style diet that, on average, you know, you can prevent 90% of diabetes and 80% or so of strokes and heart disease. And so it's still, as you put it, a crapshoot. I mean, there's still an element beyond our control. But it does turn out that lifestyle, when it's been studied on a population basis, is very good advice.
So getting back to pregnancy and conception, there are, what are some of the other, the issues, like when patients walk into your office, a couple, and they've tried to conceive, a lot of times they say, well, you know, you're trying too hard. Go on vacation and maybe it'll happen. So, you know, and I know you do your diligence in ruling out obstructions and the fact that the woman is having trouble ovulating or the man's sperm count is too low, and those things we like to touch upon throughout the interview. But What advice do you give them as kind of like the beginning of your search to help them?
Yes. Well, first of all, most people find it insulting when they get that message from a healthcare provider, you know, just relax and it'll happen, or go on vacation, or stop trying. I touch on that in the book when I talk about this element of beyond our control, and sometimes having to surrender and you know, do everything you can, and then accept what is. But it's a very tough conversation with people who are desperately trying and not being successful. Having said that, I think we always begin with a careful history. It is striking to me how some of the messages out there, for example, that people conceive on the 14th day of a cycle. Maybe. you know, women's cycles are all different, and so learning your fertile signs and being able to use either cervical mucus, a sense of wetness at the vulva, using basal body temperature, using, if you're a high-tech person, an ovulation predictor kit, very much more expensive than the bodily signs, the natural signs. But, for example, the Creighton method, which is you know, tied to the Catholic Church, but the Creighton method has been studied for natural family planning, which means it could be used both to help you get pregnant or to prevent pregnancy, and 76% of women become pregnant the very first month that they try. So if you really carefully learn your body signals, you will know your most fertile time. There are male factors. You know, again, while people tend to know if you're in a hot tub, you might knock out your sperm because the sperm are exquisitely sensitive to things like heat. You know, there may be things like putting that laptop directly on your lap, which besides the electromagnetic field that it creates, just the heat that it creates could possibly be having an effect. And so just speaking with a couple about what their habits have been and taking a careful history and beginning to discover, are there any easy things that could be addressed? Sometimes women's luteal phase is too short. That's the second half of the cycle. If it's too short, the egg may have been fertilized, but it doesn't implant. There's not enough time for it to implant in the endometrial lining. So are there things you can do to support a longer luteal phase?
Well, that ties into the pituitary, because that's what that's partially what controls that and the hypothalamus
right.
The production
of LH,
right?
So it could be a pituitary issue, but it could be as simple as asking a woman to cut back on her exercise, because up to 75% of recreational athletes will intermittently or regularly, it sort of splits about in half, have a luteal phase defect.
Right.
I'm always trying to get the patients I see to exercise regularly and to exercise somewhat vigorously. But this is the one time in life where I find myself saying to people, you know, would you be willing to back off on the exercise you're doing? This is the wrong time to train for a marathon. It's the wrong time to be doing Ashtanga yoga. This is a time to be doing much more quiet activity, whether it's walking or restorative yoga, because vigorous exercise can shorten your luteal phase. Sometimes something as simple as prescribing 750 milligrams of vitamin C is enough to support a longer luteal phase. It increases the progesterone. Sometimes progesterone is used. But again, if you can begin to understand some of the simpler, more easily reversible factors that may be impeding conception, then you can address those.
Right. And tell us a little bit about, let's go over the cycle for those that don't know about the cycle, that particularly men out there, potentially, they may not be aware that, you know, women have a particular cycle, and it's governed by what's happening at the uterus level. In other words, what's actually happening to the lining of the uterus, what's happening to the ovarian hormones, and then higher up on the chain with the pituitary, hypothalamus, even body temperature changes and other changes like that.
Yes, so I do write a chapter about normal physiology. I'll just tell you a quick story. When I have three children, and one of my daughters in her high school health class was told any vaginal discharge was abnormal. And I, of course, had a cow because that is not accurate. Women normally have a vaginal discharge, and it varies throughout the cycle. So essentially, this teacher was giving bad information and scary information because, you know, my daughter came home and said, "Is there something wrong with me? Because right. I have a discharge. Does that mean I have a disease of some kind?" But the discharge is going to vary across the cycle from a really scant discharge that's thick, white, to translucent, stretchy, we call it of egg white consistency, when a woman is maximally fertile. And you can kind of track this, and it's one of the ways to become aware of your fertility. Now, when women have been on the birth control pill or other kinds of hormonal conception, so, you know, the Mirena IUD, which has progesterone in it, they may not be aware at all of this normal varying hormonal changes and the manifestations of them in terms of cervical mucus. Lots of girls these days are put on the birth control pill because it helps get rid of adolescent acne and it regulates their periods, which they like, and their parents are worried about them getting pregnant.
Right.
And so it's often a very easy yes when it's suggested that, okay, and then they may be on the birth control pill for, you know, 10 years or more and never really have seen their normal cycle. So it's not just men who may not be aware of these
right.
Normal physiological changes, but lots of women as well. And so it's one of those things that I recommend that in preparing for pregnancy, as you go off of your birth control, you learn what that normal cycle looks like for you. The normal cycle can be anywhere from about 24 days to 35 days. So again, this idea of a perfect 28-day cycle, which is also what a birth control pill gives you as it overrides the normal signals from the brain, is just an average. If you have a shorter cycle, you may be ovulating at day 10. Ovulation normally occurs 14 days before your menses, but that's counting backwards, and in life we don't get to count backwards.
Yeah.
And
well,
again, there is
some
range.
Unless you track it over a couple months, you know, if you track.
Yes,
track
over a couple of months, right. If you watch your cycle, you can learn patterns, and you can chart your basal body temperature, which will give you a signal. And all of these exist as free resources on the internet and are easy to find. A wonderful book, a very popular book that's almost encyclopedic but will help you is Taking Charge of Your Fertility, which has been out for more than 10 years. Tony Wexler wrote that book.
So you talk a little bit about the common problems with fertility in one of your early chapters in the book. And you talk about this condition called PCOS. Maybe touch base with that a little bit.
So polycystic ovarian syndrome, or PCOS, is a condition that we don't completely understand. It has endocrine elements, and it has elements of insulin resistance, so almost a pre-diabetes kind of state. And it's relatively common. It may manifest with irregular periods, some obesity. Often women have hair in unwanted places, like their chin or their, you know, upper lip, their abdomen, and it is one of the causes of infertility. And, you know, when I use the word infertility, the clinical diagnosis means that you are trying to conceive for a year, you have unprotected mid-cycle intercourse for a year, and you don't conceive. So it doesn't mean that you'll never be fertile, but it means that you're having difficulty. You've been trying for that year period. With PCOS, we try to normalize insulin, and we can do that with diet, so by really reducing all the simple carbohydrates that bump up blood sugar. That could be bread, potatoes, rice, pasta,
big sodas.
I'm sorry?
Big sodas.
Yes, absolutely. Sodas, even small sodas. In the Nurses' Health study and also in a study out of Denmark last year, soda was shown to be one of the factors that reduced women's likelihood of conceiving.
Wow.
And there was a linear relationship, which meant the more soda you drank, the more likely you were to have trouble conceiving, because soda is a simple carbohydrate. Whether it's high fructose corn syrup or whether it's cane sugar, it's very rapidly digested. And that's the problem in PCOS, is you get these bumps in blood sugar. The bumps in blood sugar are followed by a bump in insulin. And insulin turns out to drop sex hormone binding globulin. Now, sex hormone binding globulin is a protein that circulates in your blood, and just like it sounds, its job is to bind hormones. It binds testosterone, which is in women's bodies. It binds estrogen and progesterone, but it actually has a preference for testosterone. And so when there's less sex hormone binding globulin, there's more circulating testosterone. Mm. And anything that increases circulating testosterone increases this male dominant hormone in the body, which is going to give you that extra unwanted hair, and it's going to make it harder to conceive.
So it's good for guys as they get older, of course, but it's not as
good. I wouldn't
good.
Say soda's good for guys.
No, I know. I meant testosterone, like balancing
testosterone
as they get older.
Yes, yes.
But not for
yes,
women,
so,
that's for sure.
Yes, and, okay. And it's normal, you know, for both men and women to have a certain amount of testosterone in their systems, and it has a function. But if it gets out of balance, which is part of the problem in PCOS, it interferes with conception. You know, the other thing that looks like it may off the balance of male and female hormones is actually low-fat or non-fat milk, which was something that I learned when researching the book.
Huh. So a lot of people don't drink milk because they're allergic to lactalbumin and casein, or they're lactose intolerant. Some people confuse an allergy to milk with the fact that they're lactose intolerant too. But nonetheless, cow's milk has been villainized in a way, in some level. And people are drinking other types of milk, soy milk, almond milk, rice milk, hemp milk. What's your take on some of those things? Because I think the nuts and the seeds can also impact the hormones.
Well, first I would say that I agree with you. I see lots of people who are sensitive either to the milk sugar, lactose, or the milk protein, casein, and actually do well going off of milk. And I'm always listening in a history to any symptom that may tell me that someone has a food intolerance of one kind or another, which is different from a true food allergy where you get hives or, God forbid, go into anaphylactic shock. But people who come in and they tell me that they have lifelong constipation, or they have bad reflux, or they have bloating, you know, lots of these different gastrointestinal symptoms. Sometimes it's more subtle. They have skin rashes. So I'm always listening, and I'm very, very easily tuned to suggesting that someone try an elimination diet and reduce the milk, or reduce, eliminate for a period the milk or the wheat or whatever else might be the cause of those kinds of symptoms and therefore interfering with fertility. But it doesn't mean in my awareness that everybody has to go off of this. Some people seem to do just fine with dairy. Even those people, however, the way in which we've altered dairy, so sometimes we think we're creating a healthier food by creating a non-fat or a low-fat version. When we take out the fat, we lose that mouse feel and that satiety that is induced by eating foods that are full fat, and so we substitute, and often we substitute sugar. Well, we just talked about why sugar may be a bad idea because of the way it bumps up insulin. But the other thing that happens is that when we take whole milk and we centrifuge it and spin it at high speeds, the watery and the fatty components tend to separate, and the hormones have a preference for one or the other. So estrogen, the female hormone, and the various types of estrogen have a preference for the fatty component. But the prolactin that's in milk, which interferes with fertility, the insulin-like growth factor 1, which interferes with fertility, some of the more androgenic or male hormones, which interfere with fertility, prefer the watery component. And so when you create a non-fat or a low-fat milk, you're actually altering the balance of hormones in that milk, and it may be enough of a difference that it actually makes it harder to conceive. And indeed, in the Nurses Health study, we find that women who drink full-fat milk have less ovulatory infertility, and women who drink non-fat or low-fat or eat non-fat or low-fat dairy products have higher rates of ovulatory infertility. And so I think in this area of conception, and it may turn out to be true in other areas as well, there are studies that show that teenagers who drink whole-fat dairy or eat whole-fat dairy products are less likely to have acne, which is also a hormonally induced condition. So this is one of the places where this idea that we're creating a healthier milk by making it non-fat or low-fat turns out not to be the case.
Great stuff. We need to take a break. So
okay.
We'll be back more. And that was very interesting. I had never heard that. So thank you for elucidating us. And we'll return in a few minutes. Stay tuned right here to Progressive Radio Network. Dr. Z and the Natural Nurse. Stay tuned. And welcome back to the program. We're interviewing Dr. Victoria Mazes. Is that how you say your name, Victoria? Okay. And she's the author of Be Fruitful, The Essential Guide to Maximizing Fertility and Giving Birth to a Healthy Child. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much.
Really enjoyed that thing on dairy. Now, let's talk about some of the nutrients that we think are very important, not only for general health, but for fertility. You mentioned the Mediterranean or anti-inflammatory diet. Why is that super important?
Well, this larger question of what constitutes a healthy diet and what should we be recommending that women and men eat when they're seeking not only to nourish their own body, but to prepare their body for as healthy a conception, as healthy a pregnancy as possible. And so there have been a lot of studies actually asking that question. It's one of the areas that probably has the most research. I've already mentioned a couple of times the Nurses' Health study. This is a large study. It was of 180 18,000 nurses led by Walter Willett out of Harvard, and he started looking with one of his junior faculty, Jorge Chavarro, at fertility and what he could learn from the nurses who were seeking to conceive. And so from that study, and also supported by many other studies, come data about specific nutrients, the fats, carbohydrates, protein, and some of the particular foods that either enhanced or reduced fertility. But maybe before we even get to the nurses' health study, there have been two good-sized studies, one in Spain and the other in, I want to say, the Netherlands, that looked at the Mediterranean diet. The Spanish study was of almost 500 women who reported difficulty getting pregnant and about 1,700 matched controls. And what they found was that the women who followed Mediterranean diet had a 44% reduced likelihood of having any kind of difficulty conceiving. So the Mediterranean diet was helpful if you were trying to conceive naturally. In the study in the Netherlands, they found that women who were undergoing in vitro fertilization had a 40% lower likelihood of difficulty. They were 40% actually more likely to conceive if they were following the Mediterranean diet, which I find so interesting because in vitro, in IVF, we totally supersede women's physiology with the hormones we give, and still the diet women are eating had a 40% influence on conception or not.
Wow. Very interesting. Yeah.
So we know lots about, you know, what kind of carbohydrates, what kind of fat, and what kind of protein we actually should be eating when trying to conceive from the nurse's health study. We've already talked a little bit about sugars and simple carbohydrates. In the nurse's health study, the thing that really stood out was cold breakfast cereal. That was a food that was associated with infertility. And yet, when you go into the grocery store, all those cold breakfast cereals have the American Heart Association stamp on them as a healthy food. But you and I know that they're mostly sugar and flour. Whether they're wheat flour or rice flour or oat flour, they're usually flour and sugar, which is simple carbohydrate, which means you're going to bump up that insulin and you're going to have difficulty conceiving.
So you want to really focus on fiber, a lot of sustained fiber with a morning meal, and good sources of protein and fat.
Exactly.
Too.
And if you're going to eat carbohydrate in the morning, you know, whole grain. So a whole grain could be a cracked wheat, a wheat berry. It could be oatmeal that's steel cut oats. But it's not Cocoa Puffs, and it's not Frosted Flakes. It's not a cereal that the first ingredient is flour. The first ingredient really should be sugar, but the manufacturers have gotten clever and they've divided up their sugars into fructose and high fructose corn syrup and molasses and honey and cane sugar. And so instead of being ingredient number one, it's ingredient 3, 4, seven, nine, etc., because of the way in which they've split out the various sugars.
Now, moving on to supplements, there's quite a bit out there that one should be aware of. You break up the supplement chapter into vitamin, multivitamin or not, and then you look at quite a bit of the minerals and why they're considered very important. And then you touch base on some botanicals, which, of course, is one of my expertise, teaching botanical medicine at the University of Bridgeport. So let's talk about what's the basic essentials that you need to enhance fertility.
So this is one area where there is no controversy about multivitamins. We're all aware of headlines about the dangers of multivitamins. But
or
when it comes
to urine, have you ever heard that argument?
Yeah, I have.
Okay.
I have heard all of those. But this is one area where there's no controversy. All of the major groups, the American Academy of Family Physicians, the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology, all agree that women of childbearing age should be taking a multivitamin with folic acid. There's half of pregnancies in the United States are unplanned, which means it's not okay to just start when you're planning a pregnancy, although certainly that is a wise thing to do, but rather that we should be advising all of the young women, you know, in our lives to be taking a multivitamin with folic acid. We know that there's less infertility. The Nurses' Health study showed that for women taking multivitamins six times a week, there was 41% lower risk of infertility. There are fewer miscarriages when you take a multivitamin. Very importantly, there are fewer birth defects. Neural tube defects are reduced, heart defects, cleft palates. When women take a multivitamin during pregnancy, they have a lower risk of having a child who develops pediatric cancer. And finally, there have now been three large studies that show that taking a multivitamin with folic acid before you conceive, in the months before conception through the first month of pregnancy, is associated with a lower risk of autism. So there are so many good reasons to be taking a multivitamin, and yet only about a third of women are actually taking one.
Now, sometimes they take prescription multivitamins, and I kind of look at them and I said, these aren't like the activated B vitamins and the methylated folate, which seems to be very popular now for reducing homocysteine. They're taking calcium carbonate. So one multivitamin is not created equal.
I completely agree with you, and I did create a website when I published the book that lists the ingredients, so we can review them. But if listeners, you know, need to have a little more time to write them down, or just want to print them off, VictoriaMazesMD.com, they can find what to look for. So, for example, you need the right vitamin A. You don't want too much vitamin A. It can be associated with birth defects. So lots of multivitamins have the wrong vitamin A in them. They have palmitate or retinol palmitate, retinol acetate, a maximum of 2,500 international units if that's the form. But if you're using mixed carotenoids or beta-carotene, up to 15,000 international units when you're trying to conceive, less when you're pregnant. Iron, there has to be iron. Iron deficiency is actually relatively common in women. Men, of course, don't want any iron, but you want at least 18 milligrams of iron when you're trying to conceive. Iodine is a really critical nutrient. It's not in all multivitamins, although it should be in all prenatal or preconception multivitamins, 150 micrograms. You don't want too much iodine either, because too much will interfere with thyroid function. There's really a sweet spot for iodine.
Yeah, but I heard
methylated.
I heard that iodine is very concentrated in the ovaries. Have you read that by Dr. Jorge Fletches, who's one of the experts in integrated medicine on iodine research, and says that it's very much implicated in fertility because of its... We don't understand why the ovaries seem to sequester iodine, but it's pretty well known in alternative medicine circles.
No, I have to look that up.
Dr. Jonathan Wright and Dr. Gaby have talked about that at different conferences I've attended to. So that's kind of interesting. It's a new realm on iodine. It's just not for the thyroid. There's a lot in your muscles, a lot in your ovaries, and who knows, it may... Supposedly, it's involved in estrogen metabolism, and if you don't have enough iodine, you make some of the more carcinogenic type of estrogens. But anyway, that's not really related to fertility, but I just find it interesting.
Yeah, I will definitely look that up. Thank you for sharing that. But, you know, the bottom line is there's a sweet spot for iodine, and we don't want too little, and we also don't want too much. And so, you know, it's one of those things that sometimes people have to be careful if they're doing lots of sea vegetables. They could be getting too much, as an example. Folic acid, you mentioned, really critical that there's folic acid on board in terms of neural tube defects, in terms of preventing, in those studies, the lower association with autism. Folic acid is really key. But we're learning that there are more and more people who have this genetic variant where they don't make the methylene tetrahydrofolate reductase, and so they need methylated folate. And you can get that. You could be tested to see if you have that genetic variant. If you're having difficulty conceiving, it's definitely worth being tested for that. And then you can take methylated folate and conceive more easily. Vitamin D is really important for fertility, and you need enough vitamin D. I do recommend that people get their vitamin D level checked when they're trying to conceive, because the right amount varies. When you live like I do in Arizona, it's easy to make vitamin D from sunshine, although there's lots of people in Arizona who are vitamin D deficient. If you live in a northern state, it's much harder, certainly in the winter months. New York would be included in one of those northern states, to make vitamin D in the winter, easier in the summer if you're exposed to sunshine. You need the B vitamins. You need trace minerals, the right amount of copper and zinc. And zinc actually turns out to be very important to male fertility. Multivitamins are not just for women. There was a Cochrane review, which is one of the sources of evidence-based medicine, and when you get a positive Cochrane review, you know the evidence is really good. Up to 80% of male subfertility is due to oxidative stress, and when men took antioxidants, they were five times as likely to have, to conceive and have a child with their partners. So men should be taking antioxidants as well, although, as I mentioned earlier, they don't need any supplemental iron.
Some of the herbs, it's interesting that you mentioned that about men and the antioxidants, but some of the herbs I was writing about, because I'm going to be presenting at the Restorative Medicine Conference in San Diego in the fall on male fertility and erectile dysfunction and things like that, but some of these great herbs that we read about in the Chinese Materia Medica, like Hoshu Wu and things like that, that seems to be their mechanism of action, is they prevent oxidation of the various seminiferous tubules and the areas of the testes in a guy, where, and the Sertoli cells, where the sperm's actually made. And if you can prevent oxidation, you kind of enhance fertility. You'll also enhance testosterone, by the way, because if the Leydig cells, for instance, which are the cells also in the testes, if they're damaged by chemicals and oxidative stress and things like that, the testosterone may go down, and that might be the mechanism of action as to why the testosterone's going down. So I just found it fascinating that you pointed kind of that out as a part of fertility.
Yes, and I, in Be Fruitful, recommend that if people want to pursue herbal approaches, there's such a vast wisdom in herbal medicine. But this is an area where you maybe don't want to do too much self-prescribing,
right?
Because there are herbs that can be incredibly helpful in preparing you for pregnancy, but are actually contraindicated during pregnancy. So working with a naturopathic doctor or working with someone who's really a skilled herbalist can be very valuable. There are some safe herbs. One of the things that I sometimes recommend for people to self-prescribe is what I meant, is ashwagandha, which is an adaptogenic herb that comes from the Indian or Ayurvedic pharmacopoeia, and it's sometimes used in women as well, that can help and has been shown in studies to help male fertility. There is in that same pharmacopoeia, shatavari or asparagus racemosus is often used as an adaptogenic herb for female fertility. But maybe you can speak to a couple of your favorite herbs for fertility.
Yeah, well, like I said, I like to just nourish. I think just the nourishing herbs are one of the best. But I think one of my favorites is Vitex, and you mentioned that.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very well researched herb, and I think. But again, you really should be seeing someone who at least has some understanding of what herbs are okay during pregnancy and what herbs
right. So
are
that's
not.
The critical
great,
point.
Great suggestion. You know.
And I'm a big fan of Vitex. It is, one of the nourishing herbs, as you say, but it also can increase progesterone levels. So
yeah.
Vitex is often used when women have a luteal phase defect, that shorter luteal phase that can interfere with fertility, and it's considered a very safe herb and can be of great value.
Just so we can get your website out before we, because we have about 4 minutes in the program, I want to ask you a little bit about mind-body,
yes,
mindfulness type stuff. I can't not ask that because it's so important. But just give us some information. I don't want to have to cut you short at the end of the program about how to get your book and your website, things like that.
Sure. So Be Fruitful is available on Amazon like everything is. It's also at Barnes & Noble. And I don't know if it would be at your local bookstore or not, but hopefully it is. And then the website is victoriamazesmd.com, victoriamazesmd.com. And a lot of the information we're talking about is available on the website so that people can access it. One of the topics, we won't have time for today are the environmental chemicals, and on the website I review how people can do a self-assessment and many resources they could go to reduce the amount of environmental chemicals they're exposed to.
Yeah.
But I'm happy to talk about mind-body because I agree with you, it's incredibly important.
I'll tell you an interesting quick story. I had a couple that I was working with for infertility, and I made them make a poster board of, I made the husband and wife cut out pictures of babies and taking parents and things like that. And I made her smell baby powder just to kind of create a holographic image in the mind of this whole big step that they're trying to approach because, parenthood, I have two kids too, two teenagers. Parenthood's like one of these things that you don't really know what you're about to embark in. You think you do, but you really don't until you walk.
I couldn't agree more.
So what's your comment on using mind-body techniques to enhance?
Well, in some ways you're describing visualization and making it concrete by actually putting the images up on a poster. I think there are so many wonderful mind-body practices that can be used. And we know that the body is very sensitive to the influence of stress. The brain, the hypothalamus, communicates to the pituitary gland, which basically shuts off the ovarian signals or the signals in men in the testes when people are incredibly stressed. The message basically is it's time to focus on survival, not on reproduction. You wouldn't want to reproduce if your own survival was at risk. And so finding ways, and I call this developing a practice, that can soothe and calm and center are so valuable, not just for fertility, but for life. Whether you use breathing practices, whether you use meditation, Tai Chi, self-hypnosis, guided imagery, whatever it is that really speaks to you, and that you will do with regularity so it does become a practice, is what I recommend.
Exactly. I think that the last point is very good. You have to practice until you make perfect, because when the going gets tough, you don't want to revert back to your old stress habituation ways that are distressful. You want to embrace things that really help your body with the stress, like, you know, drinking too much coffee and freaking out and, you know, whatever like that, punching holes in the wall and whatever people do when they're really stressed out, or because you're right, I think the body, in its wisdom, tries to conserve energy to the fight or flight response versus reproductive response, yeah?
Absolutely. So maybe I can leave your listeners with a very brief, beautiful breathing meditation from Thich Nhat Hanh. And
sure.
He basically says, as we inhale, we should have one focus, as we exhale, another. So breathing in, I notice my body. Breathing out, I smile at my body. And he says the quality of the smile should be the quality of a mother's smile to her newborn baby. I would say most of us don't regard our bodies in this way. And so as we're preparing for fertility, to give great appreciation and gratitude for this body that can conceive and nurture and nourish a new life.
Thank you, Dr. Mazes. That was wonderful.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for having me.
Okay, have a great day, and we'll stay in touch. Be Fruitful, the essential guide to maximizing fertility and giving birth to a healthy child. This has been the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z signing off for this week. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.